Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akio, and if you're interested in serverless technologies, software architectures, and food talk, this episode is for you. Joining me today is Yan Cui. He's a blogger, consultant, and an AWS serverless hero. There's some good perks that come with that title. I'll put all his socials in the description below. Check him out. And with that being said, enjoy the episode. Beyond coding. Now, I mean, I've been to Portugal for the last month, and I eat a lot of foods, okay? I can't handle avocado as much anymore. Like, it upsets my stomach. And there's one thing, I can't handle any coriander, cilantro. It's not a thing.
Oh, wow.
Apparently in Portugal, they throw it on everything. So the first meal I got, they have this beautiful dish. It's called a cataplana. It's like a fish stew. They make this one pot meal. It's like a saucer, and they put it on the table and they open it. It's like the whole presentation and the way there's the whole thing with it. And I saw cilantro everywhere. I was like, well, shit, I should have said something, I guess. And then every single restaurant, if I would forget that, say I can't handle cilantro, it would just be there. And I would be like, oh, that's my fault. That's my mistake. But it's a thing. And I never knew that was a thing. Yeah.
I guess it was similar to me when I was in the, I think, what was it that we went to, you're right, after I got married, we went to Venice for our honeymoon.
Beautiful.
It was great. But then every single restaurant you go to, every single dish you have, it all starts with mozzarella cheese and tomatoes. So after about 3 days, 3 or 4 days straight of everything just being cheese and tomatoes, we're just dying for something else, even just like getting a burger or something. Yeah,
you're not going to get that. Yeah, I mean, I told you my girlfriend's Italian, and it's just, they're simple foods. Like, Italian food is amazing, but they're kind of basic, kind of generic. As you say, you get some bread, mozzarella, tomatoes. They have the most beautiful tomatoes. And yeah, at some point you want some variety. Like, give me something else. Yeah. I can't talk too much about Italian food and bad in the same context.
Oh, yeah, it's great. Yeah, just you know, want a bit of a variety and you know, get some something that's not so tomato-y.
Yeah, exactly. That's hilarious, man. That's actually what I ate a lot in Portugal as well, because they do have amazing tomatoes. But yeah, we would switch it up. Like, we lived together during COVID. We moved in together. And I came, like, before then I was living with my parents, so I didn't really cook. Like, I couldn't cook because my mom would cook. She would cook for the whole family. Then I live with her, and she knows how to cook pasta, and that was usually mostly it. So then we had to invent, okay, what else are we going to eat? Because I would otherwise, I would have pasta for lunch and pasta for dinner, and it would be the same pasta. It would be pasta with tomatoes and mozzarella, or eggplant pasta, or calafreda, which is the cold version of pasta with tomatoes and mozzarella. So yeah, but then finally I got some of my mom's recipes. My parents are both Turkish, and now we're starting to make more Turkish meals, especially now, because we've been living together for like 3 years. Now we eat a lot less pasta, which to my surprise, she actually likes as well and enjoys.
Okay.
But it's good. Yeah. Now our parents are going to come over end of this week. So it's going to be a lot of pasta probably. But man, foods and cultures, like I didn't know it was this much of a thing, but to Italian people, food is very, very important. Where we eat, and I mean, in Portugal, for example, she researches all the restaurants that are there. And then we pick the best ones. And if we have to wait in line for half an hour, she's like, yes, there's a line. That means there's good food. And I'm like, no, there's a line. I don't want to wait. So then we find a balance within there somewhere. Usually we end up waiting. And the food's really good, though.
Yeah. That's good, though. I appreciate that. You know, food culture is also very big where I'm from as well, originally from China.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, like the city where I came from, the number one hobby that everyone have was just talk about new restaurants that's opened up, which ones are good. It's almost like a prestige thing, that knowing the good restaurants just opened that no one knows about yet.
That's exactly how it feels like. Yeah, yeah. I mean, in Amsterdam, you have the same thing. I don't know if you know, there's a new pizzeria. It's called Michele's Pizza. And that one originally was in the UK. That was the only place they had. My girlfriend used to study there, and I used to travel there, come visit her. And we would get pizza there because it was one of the best pizzas we had. Right. Now it opened up a joint in Amsterdam, and it was a whole thing. And apparently everyone knew, because there was a huge line on opening day. Oh, wow. They had way too many people, way too little staff. So it was actually, I mean, quite disappointing, the pizzas and stuff like that. Some people would get the wrong order, and it was a bit of a mess. And now they're rolling a bit better. But yeah, my girlfriend knew, her sister knew. It was a whole thing. They were like, they're opening on, I don't know, March 13th. And I'm like, how the hell do you know? Apparently everything's on Instagram. Yeah.
That's funny.
That's very funny.
There's a lot of burger restaurant, well, burger joints in Amsterdam as well. Mm. And I've basically tried almost every single one of the so-called best burger in Amsterdam. And yeah. the best one I found was actually just like a tiny little joint just in the east, west of Amsterdam called the Happy Bull. Mm. They do this really nice sort of medium rare burger and just blows away all the other ones, the so-called best burger in the...
I'll go there then.
Okay, sure. Check it out. It's called the Happy Bull and... I think they only open at about 5 o'clock onwards.
Okay.
So you can't just go there for lunch, unfortunately, except for the weekend. But yeah, it's, I do a lot of research as well in terms of just know which restaurants to go to.
Yeah.
And one of the things I noticed as well in Amsterdam, or maybe just in Netherlands in general, eating out is quite expensive, even compared to London.
Yeah.
Like, especially for Asian food, you know, we go to some of the restaurants in the sort of near center of Amsterdam, and you know, every dish is about 17 euros, 20 something euros, and the same food in the sort of Chinatown in London would be £10 or maybe even less. So it's actually, I found it a lot more expensive to eat out over here than compared to London, which is quite surprising to me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've been to London quite often, and I agree with you. Amsterdam prices are high, and they keep rising. Like, I've just come back and it's going to be dreadful because Portugal, everything was cheap. Like, I would get a whole chicken and it's already cooked. Yeah. It was like $7.50. And I'm like, what the hell? And I would get a salad, like not even a big salad. Like, we're talking cucumber, tomato, onion. And that was also $7.50. So then I was like, when am I going to get the salad or the chicken? And actually in Lagos, because I stayed in Lagos for the month, they had a place and it had the top 50 best burgers. How do you say that? It was listed on the top 50 best burgers in the world. Now, I don't know what listing that exactly was, but I believed it. Like, it's a marketing thing. I'll go there. And that burger was delicious, actually. I had pineapple and just all the standards of a burger, but it was really, really good.
Pineapple, that's an interesting ingredient.
Yeah, yeah, I also thought so. But man, that burger was delicious. I went twice. There's not a lot of restaurants I went twice to, but I was like, I want that burger again. Yeah, that's some good food.
The other thing I found was it's very hard to find the lamb over here. Mm. Even if I go to kebab, I order doner kebab is beef.
Yeah.
And that's really strange as well, because coming from the UK, you know, doner kebab, there's always lamb, and get lots of lamb dishes in general. But over here, I found it really difficult to find the lamb dishes apart from getting curry or something like that. You can get some lamb curry. But a lot of restaurants just don't serve lamb.
No.
Any reason why that's the case?
No clue. Like, I make a lot of lamb dishes myself. I go to the butcher and get it. But at a restaurant, I don't see it. You're right.
Yeah. Like, up behind the, they got lots of beef and lots of pork, but just, very few places you can actually get lamb. I guess I haven't tried butcher yet. Maybe I'll do that next time.
Yeah. I always go to the Turkish butcher, and there they have it because I make a good stew with it. And especially in winter times, I love a good stew. but yeah, you're right. I haven't seen that much.
The only place where we get lamb is from I think it's like a Turkish butcher called Sahan Supermarket.
Okay.
There's one in the Amsterdam East near Ooster Park. That's the one, that's where we used to live. And we used to get, go to the butcher there, get lots of really good, oxtail and things like that, and lamb chops. But outside of that, we can almost never find lamb anywhere.
No, I would have to.
It's weird.
I don't know. Like, I don't like any of the Turkish restaurants that are in Amsterdam. And then, like, I've tried a few and I'm like, it's just not as good. And maybe I'm biased because my mom's a great cook, but still, I'm like, I could make a better meal than this. So we don't really go to many Turkish restaurants, but I know, like, there should be a lot of lamb dishes in the Turkish cuisine. There's a lot of eggplant, for sure. Right. Like, everywhere you go, you'll find eggplant on the Turkish cuisine there.
Yeah, we have lots of really good Turkish restaurants in London, just all over the place. And there's always, you can always get a really good, doner kebab or something like that, or lamb skewers or things like that.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I really miss.
For sure. I went to one in London, and then my girlfriend booked this trip to Istanbul for my birthday. We went to Istanbul and I found the same place. So apparently the original one was in Istanbul.
Nice.
And then you had the one in London as well. It was really good. Cool. It was really good. I like it when food's cheap, when going out is cheap. And it is not cheap here in Amsterdam. No, that's quite sad, actually. I guess food prices in general are going up. I heard, I've been away for a month, but I've heard prices are even more increasing now. And I guess if you're here more on a day-to-day, you just don't notice it. Your bill just keeps increasing slightly. But I've looked at the supermarket and I'm like, everything's like 5% more expensive again.
And also, I guess they're also making portions smaller as well.
Are they?
I've had quite a few cases where I've seen the packaging is about the same, but then the actual portion that you get is smaller.
Yeah.
So instead of raising prices, or maybe as well as raising prices, they're also making the portion smaller as well. You also get the inflation and the shrinkation or something like that.
What is that?
So they shrink the sizes, but keep the price the same.
Yeah, exactly. That's a different way of doing the same cost cutting. It's all about cost cutting, I guess.
Yeah. And from what I heard, London or UK in general is probably even worse in terms of the inflation and the supermarket prices going up, maybe even more so than the Amsterdam.
Yeah.
But at least the energy prices are coming down. I've been keeping an eye on my energy bill. And now it's kind of back to what I was paying before the whole sort of energy price crisis happened or started.
Yeah, I don't know. Energy bill is just something that escapes me. I looked at it and I was like, I think I should be paying more on a month-to-month basis. Right. Like I don't have a great contract, but it was like your usage is less than a one-person household.
Right.
And I'm like, how's that possible? Like our apartment is quite old. So I thought if we heat up something, it should take a lot of heating to do that. If we heat up the apartment, we're with two people, so we use a lot of electricity, we use a lot of gas. And at the end of the year, they were like, no, you're going to get money back. And I was like, I don't know how I got into this position, but my electricity bills were actually quite decent this year.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I'm happy with that.
I was kicking myself that when I signed up with Budget, I didn't lock it in for 3 years.
Oh, yeah, everyone.
I only locked in for 1 year. And then, so just as the prices go up, I was only able to get the good prices for about 2 months. And then, suddenly, you go from paying, I don't know, 30, 40 euros a month to 120.
Yeah, I was
crazy.
I thought I was going to live in this apartment for a year. So I was like, I don't want to lock in for anything more than a year. So I was like, I'll just do the bare minimum. I think I locked in for half a year and then 3 months extensions. And then I was like, oh my God, I made a mistake. But apparently the bill was fine. So
right.
I guess we're lucky with that one. Yeah. I mean, I looked you up online and there's a title that I always think is interesting because yours says AWS Serverless Hero. Mm-hmm. Can you touch upon how you got that title in the first place?
So AWS runs this Heroes program. It's similar to the Microsoft MVP program. Mm. So it's the recognition of people that are contributing to the community in some way. I think initially the program was targeting mostly people that runs community meetups, events, organizers, things like that. But then they decided to expand the sort of Heroes program to have more sort of people that not just event organizers, but just people that are contributing to the community in some way. And they wanted to, I think, had the several categories for machine learning, for developer tools, for serverless, for containers. So the Heroes program is nominated by people internal to AWS. Mm. So I've been blogging for how long now? It's about maybe 12, 13 years now.
Wow.
I've been doing that for a long time, fairly consistently. And I guess I was one of the earlier serverless adopters and was one of the earlier people that was really sharing a lot of the stuff that I was learning and figuring out along the way. And so when they broadened the Heroes program, they sort of set up the containers and serverless category. And I guess I was one of the people that was nominated to be the first batch of people that they invited into the Serverless Heroes program. And so that's how you get a title. This year they've started to require you to have more activities so that you don't have people who got the title and then stop doing things and then they will still stay as a hero. I think they want to just make sure that they give a title to people who are still continually contributing
active.
To the active and helping the community in some way. There's also parallel to the Heroes program, there's also a Community Builders program, which is a program that you kind of nominate yourself. And then they have, I guess, some committee internally that decides, you get to be invited into the program and you don't, and things like that. The Heroes program, I guess, the biggest perk you get as part of the Heroes program is that you get a free trip to reInvent. They pay for the flight,
that's some
the
good
hotel,
stuff.
Yeah, and the conference ticket as well. So, and also during the keynote, they reserved the first, I think, the first row or something for the heroes.
Wow.
So that's probably the nicest perk.
I can imagine.
Perk you get. Besides that, you also get regular, I guess, like, you know, sessions with AWS service teams. So they give you like a roadmap of what they are thinking about, and occasionally you get access to private beta for new services or new features, so you can try them out. Right. But usually when they get to that point where they engage the heroes, then it's already quite late in the cycle, so there's not a lot of things that they can actually change. They would just get some feedback.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that actually, you know, I've been hoping that they would maybe change, so that get people involved a bit earlier, get the feedback a bit earlier. And I'm seeing some of that already in terms of, you know, it's the AppSync team, for instance, getting feedback from people, not just from the Heroes program, but from customers.
That's good.
Yeah, for like things that they've been working on, like the JavaScript resolver things that they released last year, and as well as the new merged API thing that they've released just a couple of weeks ago. So hopefully that's going to be more of a common thing you see across the AWS teams, but obviously every team is different.
Yeah.
It's it's one company with like hundreds and hundreds of startups within the same company. So there's a lot of inconsistencies in terms of how different teams work. But the Heroes program is really good for me, just in terms of giving me some, I guess, authority as a consultant. That really helps. Even though I guess the program doesn't really recognize competence. It's not a competence program. It's a community contribution.
Yeah, it's like a visibility thing.
Yeah, but it's still a good thing for visibility. Yeah,
for absolutely. Sure. Yeah, I mean the perk you touched upon, going to re-event. Like at CBA, we get like a study budget, and it's quite a substantial budget. And people save that budget until the end of the year when re-invent happens. They book the plane, the hotel, and the whole conference, and they save up and they spend all of that on that conference. So a lot of people would be jealous if they heard that's what you get.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Probably not the best use of a study
budget. They're making use of it.
Yeah, they're making use of it, which is good, but it's probably not the most efficient use of a study budget because it's quite expensive. And honestly, I mean, the last couple of years, last couple of times I've been to re:Invent, I haven't really been to any sessions because all of them are recorded. Not the breakout sessions, anyway.
Yeah.
You go to the Chalk Talks. Those are more interactive, and the workshops are pretty good as well. And spend most of my time in Vegas just catching up with people, because that's the only time when everybody around the world kind of just gather together.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that I only ever talk to online, finally, that was a bit my one chance every year to see them in person, and it's kind of have that networking, that's the socializing, which is what I tend to do most of my time with at the re:Invent. All the breakout sessions are pretty much available the next day on YouTube. So anything that's good that you can always just watch on YouTube at your own time, and also at 1.5 speed or something, so it's faster, more efficient.
Speed through it, exactly. Yeah. But it sounds like an awesome experience. Like I haven't been personally. But if I hear people and talk about the stories that they have on there and just the experiences and meeting people, it does feel like I'm missing out. So maybe I should go.
Yeah, it's just if you haven't been before, definitely try to go at least once. Especially now that the in person events are kind of back. I think the last re:Invent was like a mix of in person and virtual. So from what I've heard from a lot of people that went, it's a bit weird, still a bit awkward, but I think this year is going to be fully in person. So maybe save up your study budget.
Yeah, I might go. Good stuff, man. Yeah, I mean, just to preface this, I'm a fan of serverless technologies. I haven't been using them as long as you have, but from what I've seen, it's just I love getting fast up and running, getting out of proof of concept as fast as possible, low overhead with regards to operations and thinking about that, and just really focusing on delivering value, again, as fast as possible. Is that also, and especially early on, what you saw where the serverless technology was going?
Yeah. So I guess my first exposure to sort of Lambda was about 2015, I think. That was just before they introduced the API Gateway integration. So at that point, it still feels like a toy. There's the S3 integration, there's the Kinesis integration, which it's okay for some stuff, but then you can't really build the entire application, or entire system on using just Lambda and things like that. But then once they introduced the API gateway, that became, okay, now you can actually build a REST API using API gateway and Lambda and don't have to manage any infrastructure. I've been using AWS since 2010. Mm. So I've run through the whole journey of using EC2 and the containers and then Lambda. And I remember back in the day, I was building very different things, but then you kind of do the same thing over and over every time you've got a new project, which is, you decide your web framework or whatever, and you write your application, there's a bunch of boilerplate stuff you got to do before you can write your first line of business logic.
Yeah.
After that, okay, there's a lot of boilerplate stuff you got to do around the infrastructure. You got to configure the networking, which requires pretty much a whole university degree just to understand all the different things you got to do.
Yeah.
All the scaling, all the patching machine images, and also don't forget you have to do this every couple of weeks, every couple of months to
maintain just
make sure to maintain it. You've got the latest security updates and all of that stuff, which again, just things that you don't have to do once give that responsibility to AWS.
Yeah.
And I remember spending about 70% of my time just doing a lot of that stuff, so that I can spend 30% of my time doing the stuff I actually need to do, which, I mean, it's still quite fast compared to what I was doing before, because I started my career in banking and, we were waiting for, about 6-9 months to get a new server into our farm. And, you had these crazy meetings with 20 people talking about, oh yeah, I need to have this thing installed on the new server. I need to have that thing installed on the new server.
Yeah.
And once it's installed, everyone memorizes the login credentials and an IP address because you're going to be logging onto that server pretty frequently. So that's like a whole year-long project to get a new server into your farm. And then going to AWS is a five-minute thing. I get a new server.
Yeah.
So that's already revolutionary. But then, there's still a lot of boilerplate stuff you got to do, especially as AWS adding more and more controls you can have around the networking and the auto-scaling, all of that stuff, which is great. But then at the same time, if I just want to write some web app, I don't really need all of that. Yeah. And unless I'm dealing with a super high scale, super high throughput, a basic box standard thing that works for 90% of cases is just fine for 90% of my cases.
Yeah.
And so once Lambda came around and became more capable in terms of being able to build API, REST APIs with it and be able to do all these other things with it, then it just became a no-brainer for me to use it. And I haven't looked back since just because I know how much work it takes to actually do EC2s and containers. And I don't want to spend all of that effort on things that's not going to add any value to my customers. And I was doing a project for a client, I think about 2-3 years ago. The client had an idea for a social network. The first sort of attempt at this, they hired a guy to build it in PHP, and then they did something pretty quickly together, and then they launched it, and at launch it just kind of fell apart. They had two servers. I just couldn't handle the number of people that's trying to log in,
or
trying to sign up. So it was kind of embarrassing how bad it went. And so they got some more funding, and they had a second attempt at this, second chance, and they really wanted to just make sure that they get it done right, to get it done quickly as well, because
they're behind.
It's a social network for university students. So it had to be tied to semesters. May or September, when the next semester starts, everybody's going to be, that's when everyone's going to sort of start to create an account so that they can book sporting sessions with the university's, gym or something like that.
Okay.
There's a pretty short deadline to get it done, and they need to get it done and also make sure that, whatever they end up with is going to be able to handle some kind of scale, which is, it's not like a heavy amount load, but it's just in talking about tens or hundreds of people signing up and being able to use the app at the same time, which is fine. We built it with AppSync and the Lambda functions and things like that. We got the whole thing done in about 4 weeks. I was the back one, I was the one man backend team, was built the whole thing, including standing up the entire AWS organization, multiple accounts, following a lot of the best practices around the security and an account management, and then build the application. But we also build a CMS as well. Again, all of that stuff is just so easy and so quick to build. We were able to get it done before the deadline. And also, launch day, lots of people signed up. I think we got about 15,000 people signed up in the first week or two.
Yeah.
Everything just went smoothly. There was no errors, no reports from any customers. So the client was really happy.
I can imagine. Yeah.
It's the sort of thing that would have taken like whole team much longer to do if they had to, you know, worry about all these other infrastructure stuff, worry about all of these you know, things that besides what the customer is actually asking you to build, because you need to do those things to be able to, you know, scale to demand, not have any problems when the, you know, you got more than a handful of people signing up at the same time and things like that. And with serverless, you've got a really good sort of baseline for resilience and for scalability and for security. And of course, you know, if you have full control of your environment and you know very well what you're doing and you're dedicated to doing the specific things really well, you can do better than what you get with Lambda. But for 90% of cases, you don't need better. You just need good enough.
Yeah.
And what Lambda gives you out of the box is good enough, well, probably even better than most people can do on their own, because they have to worry about so many other things besides the network security.
Yeah, yeah.
They got to worry about actually building the application that the clients, you know, your users want, besides just, you know, focusing on security. And AWS can dedicate the entire teams of people just on looking after your network environment, and they can do a much better job than most people can.
Yeah, and then it's not your problem anymore.
It's not your problem anymore.
Yeah.
Now, when there's a downtime, sure, you still have to worry about the, you know, resilience and things like that. And you get much better sort of baseline resilience just because you get multi-AZ out of the box when you're using things like Lambda and DynamoDB and API Gateway, where you have to, you know, provision servers in multiple regions yourself. You've got to work out how much capacity you need to have in each region so that if one region goes down, one AZ goes down, you still can cover all of the traffic you've got, and you've got to set up a load balancing and all these things like that, which besides the fact that it's more work to do, but you're also paying for a lot of redundancy that you're not going to be using.
Yeah.
And so for a lot of the applications you see out there, unless they're doing really high throughput, Lambda is probably going to be cheaper and safer and faster and better than to run your own infrastructure.
Yeah.
Of course, you've got examples like the Prime Video, where they got the sounds like very specialized workload, but have to cater for quite high throughput, which they didn't foresee at the time. So it turns out that because of the traffic that they ended up having to serve, it made more sense to move the workload to containers. And that's one of the things that once you get to certain sort of throughput and scale, using service components is going to be more expensive because you're paying for that premium per request. So if you have a really high number of requests consistently, then that premium is going to be more expensive than, say, if you were to hire someone to come in and dedicate on managing infrastructure.
Yeah.
And that's the cost that a lot of people don't see when they think about, I can run containers for, and then $100 a month versus running this thing on API Gateway and Lambda would cost me $150. Let's just run those containers. Mm. Oh, but wait, we need someone to actually do this thing. Can I hire a guy? Yeah, sure. That'd be $5,000 a month. So your actual savings, $50 versus your actual expenditure
a person
to hire, which is usually much more expensive. But it obviously depends on how much internal skills you have. People that you say, you're doing containers for other teams already, just help us as well, which could be the case for large enterprises, which has got dedicated teams that it's going to be support a large infrastructure footprint they have for lots of different assets.
Yeah.
But for a lot of smaller companies, it just doesn't make sense to hire someone to
help
look after your infrastructure when you don't have that throughput to make up a difference in terms of the operational cost on AWS versus hiring someone to do the same job.
Yeah. And I mean, I've been a bit on Twitter as of late, a little bit more since doing this podcast. But when the Prime Video example, for example, happened, people love shitting all over it. They're like, either it's not good on the cloud, or they shouldn't use Lambda. They shouldn't have used it from the start. Like, or microservices wasn't a good option anymore. They're like, look, this is a prime example. They go haywire. They go all over the place. And I'm like, okay. Well, when you start, you probably don't know what your end situation is going to go up. Like, you iterate, you improve, and this is a big improvement for them. Right. And this is Prime Video we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Millions of people using the service, watching videos, right? It's high throughput anyway.
That's actually the interesting thing. It wasn't Prime Video. It was the one team within Prime Video that built a monitoring and built like a tool that goes through the frames. And I think they look for some problems in coding or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's one team, not the whole Prime Video. You also, I guess, Amazon is a very big company. Prime Video is also not a small team.
Yeah.
So one team may have decided to do something. It doesn't mean that the entire company has moved away from a specific technology.
Yeah.
And also, if you read the blog post, it's actually very, very reasonable what it talked about. You know, it talked about how there's already existing tool. They're just building a new version of it. Used by that many people. So they built it. They didn't think it's going to be high throughput. But it turns out the tool was actually quite good. So more and more teams started to adopt the tool that they built. It's internal tool still, but I guess it's the scale comes from the number of videos they have to analyze, the number of streams they have to process in parallel. So,
and that could be a lot. Yeah.
It could be a lot, right? Because there's a lot of videos that's available on Prime Video.
Yeah.
They hit a scaling problem that they didn't foresee, which you can't blame anyone for not being able to predict the future.
Yeah.
And so when the context changed, they revised review their architectural decisions. And also after having run this system for a while, they can spot the inefficiencies, which may be easier to build at the time, but now becomes less efficient once you have to operate at a certain scale. So what they're doing, is textbook evolutionary architecture, where you adapt and evolve as your needs and your context change, and it's absolutely fine. But people just read the text with a specific assumption in mind, specific thing that they wanted to kind of look out for, and the nitpicking small bits of context out and taking it out of context, and just Amazon's moving away from microservices. They can't make sense of microservices.
Find their own truth.
So they it's really frustrating. And anyone who's actually read the post, for what it is, with a objective mindset, will see, okay,
there's nothing
to it. This is normal.
Yeah,
this is what I expect people to do, to do something based on what they know at a time, and then then review and evolve the architecture when that change. And one of the small things that people didn't sort of pick up on as well is the fact that there's that one paragraph that talks about how when they migrated from step functions to just basically have like a orchestration running inside one a container or something like that. They didn't have to change much code because most of code is the same.
Yeah.
So that talks about, people that used to talk about how vendor lock-in, once you use Lambda, you can't move out. It's just code. They were able to take the same code, maybe do some small rewrite and put it into containers, and off they go, right? So it's also one of those things that talks about that people didn't see the fact that, it kind of debunks a lot of the sort of vendor lock-in argument.
It's such a buzz term, vendor lock-in.
It's such a lazy term as well. Most of the time, just the people trying to sort of rationalize why they don't want to do this, they don't want to learn this thing. Most of the time, I think it's just because we're bumping into identities that people have built around the tooling they use. In terms of containers, I spent all this time learning containers and Kubernetes, and now you're telling me to learn something else. Of course, I'm going to be
in the skill set that
exactly.
I know.
Someone's pushing a different sort of paradigm, different technologies, kind of invalidating my skill set, my effort that I've put into learning this other thing. What's the easiest argument I can use to throw around, which is vendor lock-in. Which is really frustrating because I've talked to a lot of people that kind of throw the argument at me, but then they can never quite substantiate exactly what are the lock-ins.
What does that mean?
Yeah, what does that actually mean? If you were the same thing, there's the same sort of lock-in exists with pretty much any decision you take along the way. If you use Restify, now I want to use the ExpressJS. Well, guess what? You're going to rewrite the application. If I want to use, MySQL, now I want to use Postgres. Well, guess what? A lot of your code is going to get rewritten. A lot of your work is going to be redone.
Yeah.
The same thing with moving technology from, say, containers to Lambda. And there's lots of different ways you can actually make that portability a lot easier. There's things like hexagonal architectures and modularity that you can do at your code level. And all of that is just actually quite easy to do.
Yeah.
And we saw in the Prime Video example that, hey, this is like a real world example of someone who moved their workload from using step functions and Lambda to moving containers, and they didn't have to rewrite entire applications, just the orchestration layer, just some parts of the application, as you'd expect.
Because of the decisions they made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had in the past in the projects where, we weren't quite sure. One of my previous jobs, full-time jobs, was working for a company called The Zone. It's the Netflix of sports streaming. So, they do They streamed live sporting events, and at peak they had like 2 million concurrent viewers when I was there. So after I left, it's probably, you know, 3 million or whatever by now. But you know, it's really high throughput, very spiky traffic. So certain parts of the sort of system, we just say, you know, you can't use Lambda because we're hitting scaling limits that Lambda has around the sudden burst of going from zero to, say, you know, what was the peak throughput we can go, you know, with immediately, instantly. And after that, you can only go up by 500 concurrent executions per minute. So we're hitting that upper bound of where sort of the scalability of Lambda sort of start to reach certain limits.
Yeah.
But for a lot of our APIs, that's not on that critical path of user coming in, logging in, and start watching, say, Man United play Man City for the FA Cup final, things like that. We use Lambda and functions a lot for a lot of the payment processing and other things as well.
Yeah.
I forgot where I was going with this, there's no technology that's a perfect fit for every single scenario, and your context is not always the same. So
yeah,
as the context change, you should evolve and review your decisions. And in terms of I remember now where I was going to go with that story. I was that some of our APIs that we weren't sure at the time when we write it, that if it's going to be end up running in containers or in Lambda functions. So we would write it so that using ideas from Hasakuno architectures, where the core business logic is wrapped inside its own modules, and then we have wrappers for, say, that we can use inside the Express.js app or inside Lambda function that calls into our domain logic. So that way we were able to really easily, so just take the API and move into a container and running Express.js or put into Lambda functions. So that portability is actually really easy to do. It's just a very simple code pattern that you can employ.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to say was with the zone example was that for different APIs, you should look at your different requirements in terms of both what you need to do, the functional requirements, but also your non-functional requirements, like, you know, what are the sort of scalability you're going to need if it's something that's for example, for the social networks I used to worked on, you know, they don't have super, they don't have 0 to 2 million people, you know, requirement
peak,
in terms of, that kind of peak throughput. But what they do have is a lot of really spiky traffic pattern, just because a lot of the traffic is driven by, say, influencers doing something. So these other social networks I used to build for one of my previous jobs back in 2016, that was one of my first sort of venture into serverless. You know, I worked with a team to move a social network to run pretty much entirely on serverless, having, it was running on containers before. We had lots of problems around scaling and other things. So we started to re-architect and sort of fix things one piece at a time. And we thought the serverless was a really good fit for us.
Yeah.
And so we're using the strangler pattern to move things, one vertical at a time into different services. And as we do that rewrite and re-architecture, we will also rewrite the code into Lambda functions instead. One of the things we saw was that the traffic pattern was really spiky. Sometimes you get 20x spikes just because an influencer posted something. Mm. And so for those kind of spiky traffic that's unpredictable, Lambda is really good because you got a lot of scalability out of the box. But with the zone example, the problem is that we're hitting upper bound of how far Lambda is allows you to scale in one jump.
Yeah.
So there's certain cases where, you know, the scalability, there's like a range in which Lambda is really good compared to containers in the zones example, because a lot of that, the traffic spikes are predictable. It's because there's a match on at 7 o'clock and everybody logs in at 6:59.
Yeah.
So we go from like almost maybe a few hundred requests per second to tens of thousands requests per second within like a 20 second window. So
that's
that kind
huge.
Of spike, it's predictable when it's going to happen. But the spike is so high, that it's so big that we were hitting limits on what you can do with Lambda's burst capacity.
Yeah.
So that's why we made the decision that for anything that's going to be on that critical path and it's going to experience that kind of traffic spike, we're not going to put stuff in Lambda function. We're going to use containers instead, where we have a bit more control around the scaling, just based on the timing, based on our schedule for when the matches are going to be on. But for other things I worked on, like the social network example, where the traffic spikes are unpredictable, but they're not so big that we're going to hit any sort of scaling limits around Lambda. So Lambda is a really good fit for that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Did you work with Ariel Weinberger by any chance at The Zone?
I didn't work with him directly, but I was I know of him, and we had some conversations afterwards as well. Yeah. I think he also did a course on, I think, Next.js or something like that on Udemy. I think he did quite well on some of his courses. I had some conversation with him, but I never really worked with him directly.
Okay, cool. Yeah, he's come on the podcast as well.
Okay.
I did a job interview. This was like a year and a half ago, and he was sitting across from me actually on the other side of the table. And I remember he worked at The Zone as well. Some interesting challenges with regards to traffic and stuff there.
Yeah, so The Zone was a really good, really interesting technical challenge. And I think there's also, I don't know if you spoke with many other The Zone people. Mm-hmm. There are some really interesting stories around how the Amsterdam office was put together.
I haven't heard anything about that.
Okay. No. Yeah. So it was put together really quickly. We hired lots of people, but then didn't hire enough managers. So there was some initial problems in terms of just a bit of a lack of direction, I guess, because you have too many people, but then there's not enough managers and not enough support structure around them.
Doesn't happen often, does it?
Maybe I don't know. The Zone was really interesting, sort of a learning experience for me in terms of just scaling an organization very, very quickly and putting a lot of things into place, things like platform teams and the hiring practices and interview practices and things like that.
Awesome. I'm thinking back because, again, I'm a fan of serverless technologies. I'm a fan of this movement that allows people to go to the cloud and deliver value faster. And I don't care what serverless technology it is that much, because as you said, you have to be evolutionary with regards to your technology, right? Mm-hmm. So you use what's most apt for whichever use case you have. And not everyone is a prime video. So peak traffic, you have to figure out what your own peaks are going to be. And if they hit higher than you expect, then you adapt accordingly, right? It's a normal process. The same is with your skill set. If you've learned Docker and Kubernetes, you still have those skills. You can still try other things. They'll be afraid to adopt new technologies in that way. But then still, in this era, I'm again going to reference an article I saw. There was this article, and I think it was a few months ago, where there was this guy, and they said, we're going to save like millions, probably in the 5 or 6 millions, by moving off the cloud this time. Mm-hmm. And there was a whole post about, okay, this specific part of our infrastructure and this serving, I think it was of images specifically. Don't know if it was images. But in any case, he laid out this whole thing about the costs and the benefits of running his own racks and knowing exactly what to do. But for me, the part that wasn't there was the operational cost of the people that was going to maintain this part. And I don't know if it's going to add up to the millions, but obviously people jumped on that. The same with the Prime Video example, where they said, okay, maybe we shouldn't put everything on the cloud. Maybe in this case, it wasn't such a good idea. Do you remember the article I'm talking about?
There were a couple. There was one from, I think, DHH, the guy that founded the bootcamp, and he was talking about Hey.com, I think.
That's the one.
That's the one?
That's the one.
Right. Yeah, there was another one from another company that's, I think they do SEO. I forgot the name of the company now. But they were talking about how they would have spent $400 million or something like that on AWS if they had run their stack on the AWS instead.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's also completely wrong as well. for the estimate, I think he just did some back on a napkin calculations and work out. Oh, yeah, this is how much we're paying now, and based on the sort of the CPU you're gonna get on AWS for a sort of equivalent service on an hourly rate, this is gonna how much you end up spending.
Yeah, so very black and white.
Yeah, and also when you consider the fact that I think I was looking at the amount of money that Netflix spent on EC2, and it was. It was less than the amount that they reckoned they would spend on AWS for EC2.
Yeah.
And when you consider that this is a SEO company, not Netflix. Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that they wouldn't have spent nearly as much as they said.
Yeah.
The DHH article, remember that as well. He's an odd one. He's obviously, you know, quiet, very smart guy, and sure, done a lot of things in his career. But then he's totally against the microservices and totally against the cloud. Yeah. I don't really know where that's coming from. Yeah. But at the same time, I mean, I guess some of the sort of arguments he talks about, how in terms of, okay, you know, microservices is not right for everyone. But no, nothing is right for everybody. Exactly. And personally, I still think that monolith is a good choice for a lot of use cases. Even when you're doing Lambda function, building with serverless, I still quite prefer building monoliths, especially when I just build in the first version of something. I'm the only person working on it. It doesn't mean that I have to have just one Lambda function or something like that, because a Lambda function is not a microservice.
No,
it's just a component that's part of your system. A monolith, I've got one code base, one repo, one deployment for one sort of system, and that system happened to be my GraphQL API running in AppSync with a bunch of different Lambda functions and DynamoDB tables. I mean, that's still very monolithic to me. So yeah, when I want to change something, that's one place to go, and one deployment that deploys everything. That's to me, that's not a microservices. When I've got a company with 500 people working on the same our system, I want to have microservices, because it allows me to scale the team so that individual developers only touch one small part of a system, and they only need to understand how that particular system works
independently.
Yeah. And importantly, also, if they mess up or something happens to their system, it's not going to bring down the entire application, the entire system, right? So microservices is really powerful tool for scaling the organization. Yeah. I understand that for Hey.com, maybe they don't have hundreds of engineers that necessitates microservices. I appreciate that one of the most common misconceptions about microservices is that, and people tell me this all the time, is that, it's there to scale your application. It's absolutely not to scale your application. If you don't know how to scale a monolith, you're not going to know how to scale a microservice architecture.
Yeah.
One of the sort of the most scalable monolith I know is, I used to work for a games company, and they got bought by Supercell. And from that, I've spoken with a lot of Supercell engineers and got a glimpse of their stack, which is very, very simple. It's one big jar, Java application jar. They deploy to EC2, horizontally scaled, and horizontally scale, and horizontally sharded the MySQL database, very simple, like 2-3 tier application. But they handle millions or millions of concurrent users just by scaling the monolith a very simple way horizontally. And if you don't know those scaling patterns and apply to individual services, because when you look at individual services within microservices, it's the same scaling challenge of scaling a monolith. It's one service, one system. And so it's absolutely not about scaling your application. It's about scaling your organization so that you can have hundreds and hundreds of people working on the same project at the same time. If you look at construction projects, we have 3,000 people working on the same site. But if they're all just hammering the same nail, you're not going to be able to have that many people working on the same project at the same time, right? So microservice is the same way. So it allows you to segregate your bigger building site into lots of different small areas, so that different people can just work on one part, one floor, or maybe one part of the job, like mixing the materials, or nailing the boards or something like that, so that you can have people working on individual tasks within the smaller sort of domain, so they can become easier to onboard new people as well. Microservices is good for some cases, maybe more around your organization than the technical challenge that you're trying to solve.
I came into a project, because I mean, I work at a consultancy company as well, and there they started off with a microservice architecture, and I was like, okay, interesting, because I wouldn't start off with it like that,
right?
And then very soon we noticed that two of the services were very interdependent on each other, and I was like, yeah, that makes sense, because we just decided those were going to be separate microservices. But when we needed to change one, we also needed to change another, and sometimes even a third one. So then we're like, okay, these are not really interdependent. So we just made this kind of distributed system, and it didn't make sense anymore. So we were like, okay, wipe that off the table. We're going to start with a monolith. And then we're going to see, okay, what parts need to actually be separate from different teams. And we haven't even gotten to that point yet. It's the same scale. We're just as fast. We're even faster, because we don't have to go to different repositories, change different things. It's all in the same spot. And now when there is going to be a separate team, because that's going to happen pretty soon, actually, then we're going to be like, okay, these things we're going to split off, and that makes sense for that team.
Yep.
That's how we're going to grow organically. not by deciding, okay, this is what it's going to be end state and then working like that, because that just, it really diminished our speed, I noticed. And it was a real hard argument because the person sitting across from me was like, okay, it's really hard to go from a monolith to microservices. And I'm like, no, the way we have it now is really hard to operate it. And it's way easier to transition when it actually needs to happen. But that argument, yeah, we had to learn how to trust each other and how to actually evolve the system and wipe some things off the table and redo it. Just mm-hmm. for the fact that we were losing a lot of speed, I felt like.
Yeah, I've seen that quite a few times. In fact, one of the things that if you listen to a lot of the microservices advocates, one of the first things to say is that no, don't start with monolith.
Yeah.
Until you know the system, you know where the
microservices.
The
sort of, you mean?
Yeah. Start with monolith.
Yeah.
Until you know where the separations are, and then you can. You know, break out things into microservices. But yeah, the microservices advocates won't, you know, they don't tell you to start with microservices.
No.
They tell you to start with monolith, learn about a system and where it makes sense to split, then you split. Like I say, it's not something that you just go in there straight away. Unless you're moving from, say, like an existing system where you already been running this thing for a while, and that's the case with the zone where the first version of it was built by a third party company. It was one big monolith. So by the time I joined the company and started hiring hundreds of engineers, we already know what the system and where where the separation should be.
Yeah.
So we had a pretty good idea in terms of. How to split the team. The teams at the time, well, reasonable idea in terms of how to split the team. And the zone also uses a micro front end as well, which is a microservices applied to the front end, which is quite interesting. But yeah, so a lot of that is because, we ended up, we're going to have a company with hundreds of engineers. We're going to want them to be able to own specific part of the system and be able to iterate independently. And also, if one team have a problem with their services, don't bring down the whole system, which is actually something that you have to invest and build with that in mind.
Yeah.
Because with microservices, it's really easy to build those inter-service dependencies. That's the tight coupling that if one service goes down, you have this,
effect.
Cascaded failures.
Yeah.
So you have to build those your system with that in mind. And that's one of the things that I really love about event-driven architectures. It's really very natural way to remove that the tight coupling between different services just by depending on events from each other, as opposed to relying on a synchronous API calls between different services.
Yeah, I think for me the hard part, and I'm thinking back to this argument, is experience is what drives people, right? So if you've seen something work well in the past, you're going to lean on top of that experience and be like, this is what worked well in the past. And if you saw something that didn't work so well in the past, it's hard to be like objectively look at, okay, why was it that it didn't work that well? And why in this case, can it work well or can it work better? What can we do differently and still make it work? I feel like that really drives a lot of arguments. And in this case, maybe even with the example of vendor lock-in, it really drives a lot of arguments. And then it fails. Or some people fail to look at it objectively and be like, okay, maybe in this case we can do differently. Maybe we can do the same, but have it be a success instead of a failure in the past.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's missing from a lot of the online content is the people give you the headline, oh, something happened, so we changed. But
people were like, I was right. Look at it.
Yeah. But then they don't give you the context, like why.
Yeah.
And that's the one, that's a bit I should look out for, why. Did that work for you and not for somebody else? Because something always works for somebody and not for somebody else. Medication is the same thing. We talk about intermittent fasting. I can do one meal a day for 10 months. Maybe you can't, maybe I can eat avocado. You can't.
Yeah.
So then something is always going to work for some people and not for others. So that context is how you go beyond the surface or just scratching the surface that naive thing that says this thing doesn't work.
Yeah.
To say, okay, understanding when this thing works. And that's something that I think is missing from a lot of the content out there. And that's one of the things I've had a few colleagues and friends come to me and ask me to sort of, review their blog posts. And that's one of the things I always sort of kind of feedback to people who are starting to blog is, explain the context.
I like that.
A lot of people, they go straight into the solution to say, here's what I did. Here's my beautiful, elegant solution. And one of the first feedback I often give is, sell the problem first. Until people care about the problem, you're trying to solve, they're not going to really care about your solution, or they're not going to understand why your solution works and for you, but not for them when they try to copy it.
Yeah.
And it always sort of brings me back to that scene from Wolf of Wall Street, where the Punisher, the actor, his role, they were all sitting at a table, and DiCaprio's character asked him to sell me a pen. He doesn't go into describing how the pen is awesome. He tells you, oh yeah, I forgot what it was.
It was a whole story where at the end he actually needed the pen.
Exactly.
And then this was the pen.
So he created a need for a pen. I think to something to write down, like a check or something like that. I'll give you a check, but you need a pen to write it or something like that. So he created a need for the pen, and then he started selling the pen. And that's something you need to do for your content as well. Create a need for your solution before you try to sell the solution to your readers. And I think that's something that's missing from a lot of content out there. But when you do see them, they're really good at, okay, explains, now here's my situation, here's my context, and this is the problem that we had, and the solution, here's our solution, and it works for our context because we are a large company. Microservices works for us because we need to be able to allow people to come in and just work on one part of the system without having to know everything else that's happening in the system, and be able to have an application that is going to be resilient to small failures, to small parts of the application. And I actually got some nice examples as well from what happened when you don't really do that properly. One of the companies I used to work for, and they had this thing, they went through kind of the microservices sort of evolution. Again, it's large company, not enterprise, but a mature startup with lots of users and lots of engineers. They kind of did the microservices thing on their service boundaries, but then they were still using a shared database. And so there was one time when someone from the customer support team did something in like internal tool, which ran a really heavy query. Took down a database. Because they didn't have a read replica for the customer support tool, because everybody or a lot of different services was using the same shared database, so you've got a distributed monolith. So it took down the entire system for the whole weekend. And the funny thing is, this is a food delivery service, the cost of moving for the customers is really low, so all the customers went to another food delivery service. And funny thing is, the other service also wasn't doing very good in terms of architecture, so it took down the other services as well. So I guess from a business point of view, they didn't really suffer too much from that outage, but it was enough to for them to rethink a lot about the architecture. And they actually hired a really good person I know into the company just to kind of fix a lot of that problems that they didn't that they had.
That's painful.
That's kind of shows you one of the problems that you have with when people just don't really understand what microservice is, and just doing this sort of surface level, we just add a service, but then not really following through and understanding that, okay, when you have microservices, services should be autonomous, they should be independent. They shouldn't be sharing the same database, otherwise it's going to create this implicit coupling and the single point of failure. Which is one of the, really nice story. Well, maybe not nice, but really interesting story that I've had from that.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, it's the same with people looking for solutions, right? Or explaining the solution more so than explaining the context is also, I can put a microservice up, but is it really needed? Like, why do I need this microservice in the first place, right?
Yep.
And do I understand why microservices or how they work interdependently from each other, or what a well laid out architecture would be? If someone runs a query on the database, this is going to cascade and it's going to like flatten my whole system. Or do we have a read replica for that, for example? You have to understand why and when to use what's apt, but that's not the fastest way, because the fastest way is just to use the solution you think is right. But that can have severe consequences.
So that's something that I try to integrate with all of my content, making sure that I always explain the context and try to do as good a job as I can to explain why the solution works when the solution works.
Good stuff, man. This was a lot of fun, Jan. I'm going to round it off here. Jan, thank you so much for coming on. I'm going to put all Jan's socials and links to his blogs in the description below. Check him out. Let him know you came from our show. And with that being said, thank you for listening. We'll see you on the next one.
Thank you.